All right, we will get started now. So good morning, assuming that you're all in the Western Hemisphere. It's good to see you. Please feel free to take yourselves off mute and speak up at any point in the share. We don't have that overwhelming a crowd that we can't do this as if it were a live group. So feel free, but otherwise you can also use the chat and we can continue the conversation that way. Okay, so I gave this year the title of Why Does Sefer Vayikra Start Here, which actually assumes something about the Svarim in Chumash. It assumes that the five books of Chumash each have an identity. It has a literary structure. There's a reason that Sefer Bereishit begins and ends where it does, that Sefer Shmot begins and ends where it does, Vayikra the same, and so on. This is not actually entirely obvious. Certainly you could think of an alternative that essentially Chumash is an extraordinarily long book and we need to cut it in some way. But that's of course not been the usual way of thinking about it. And it's pretty clear in some of the cases that the Chumashim do have identities. So that's certainly clear in, the clearest is probably Devarim, which is all Moshe's long speeches at the end of his life. Starts with that introduction and it goes till his death. The interesting thing about Devarim is actually not where it begins, but the fact that it doesn't include the Knisa la'aretz. That, of course, not a question just about Devarim, but a question about Chumash in general. If Chumash is a story of Bnei Israel being promised the land of Israel, leaving the land of Israel, being in Mitzrayim, Shibur Mitzrayim, Yitziat Mitzrayim, and then the Geula, which we'll talk more about in a few minutes, it certainly could have been reasonable to expect they would actually include the Kibush and Nachla, or at least the Knisa la'aretz. And that, of course, is not in Chumash. That's only afterwards. So in a sense, we have to readjust our expectations once we find out that Chumash ends with the death of Moshe Rabbeinu. But Devarim clearly has a beginning and an end. That's true for Bereishit as well. And I'm going to put up some slides on the screen. There we go. And give me a second to start this. There we go. Put up some slides on the screen. The Ramban is the one who first pointed this out. The Ramban in his Hakdama, in his introduction to Sefer Shmot, says, Yishlima katub Sefer Bereishit shehu Sefer ha-yitzira b'chidush ha-olam v'yitzirat kol notzar. So we're finished with the book of creation. Sefer Bereishit is the book of creation. The beginning is obviously creation, and the rest of it, he says, and this is of course based on his Kabbalistic approach to the Sipurei Ha'avot, is also creation, because everything that the Avot did created pathways for their descendants to walk through. That's not our issue for today, so that's good. And now we're going to start another book, which has the identity of explaining what happens because of what the Avot did. And then the Ramban says, as I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, and then we'll look at what he means in a bit of detail. He says, look, this has to be a new book because the beginning of the book actually repeats what we already had in Bereishit Mem Vav. So let's look at that for a second. Sefer Shmot began, Eilish Shmot Bnei Yisrael Abayim Mitzrayim Ha'ayit Yaakov Yishu V'Tov Ba'u, Ruvain Shimon Levi V'Yudah, and so on. So this is, of course, the first few psukim in the book of Exodus. And it ends, V'Yi Kol Nefesh Yotzei Yaakov Shivim Nafesh V'Yosef Hayav Mitzrayim. Now, what the Ramban is just observing is that this is not new information. In fact, just a few prakim earlier, back in Bereishit Mem Vav, we had read, the only additional information here, and is the reason that this paragraph is so much longer than that paragraph at the beginning of Shmot, is because here we have not just the first generation, not just the children of Yaakov, but also the grandchildren. So, Uvnei Reuven, Chanoch, Falu, V'chatzron, V'charmi, and so on. But you see that it starts exactly the same way and it ends exactly the same way. Kol ha-nefesh ha-baal Yaakov Mitzrayim ha-yotzei yirichol milvah neshe b'nei Yaakov kol nefesh ha-shim v'sheish v'nei Yosef asher yulad lo b'mitzrayim nefesh shnayim kol ha-nefesh l'beit Yaakov ha-baal Mitzrayim ha-shivim. So the Ramban simply observing that what we have at the beginning of Sefer Shemot is actually just a recap, just a sort of short epitome of a longer paragraph that we had back in Breshit Mem Vav. So the Ramban's observation, which is clearly on target, then leads him to the conclusion that Sefer Shemot repeats this information because it has to go back and tell the story from the beginning. So in other words, this is a literary point. We don't need this information because it's new information. It's not new information, but it has to be told in Sefer Shemot. And now I'll pick up in this passage on the slide in front of you. Ba'avur ki yiritam sham hu reshit hagalut ki me'az hu chal. Has to tell us that because Sefer Shemot has an identity. It's the book of the Galut and, as I'll say in a second, of the Geula. In order to be the book of Galut and Geula, it has to tell us about the Galut. So even though we already knew that the children of Yaakov were there and we even knew their numbers, Sefer Shemot has to begin with that because it's the book that tells us the story of the exile and the redemption. Now, where does Sefer Shemot end? And this gets us to the heart of our question of why Vayikra begins where it begins. Ramban says, "V'hine ha'galut einenu nishlam ad yom shuvam al mekomam ve'al ma'alat avotam yashuvu." You can't say that the exile ended until they've returned to their place and to the level of their ancestors. U'kishe yatzu mimitzrayim, afa pishe yatzu mibeit avadim, adayim yichashvu golim. So when they left Egypt, even though they had left the house of slavery, they're still considered exiles. This is not a book that Ramban's emphasizing. It's not a book of bondage and freedom. It's a book of exile and redemption. Galut and geula, not avdut and chirut. So the fact that they're free already, let's say in Perek Yudalet or Perek Tedvav, that's not the end of the story. It's not a story of going free from slavery. It's a story of being redeemed from exile. They're still in exile. Ki ayu ba'aretz lo lahem nivuchim b'midbar. They're still in the wilderness. When they came to Har Sinai, and then they made the Mishkan, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu returned and caused his Shekhinah to dwell among them, as Shavu El Ma'alot Avotam, Shayasod Eloa Ale Ohalehem, Vehem Hem Hamerkava. So here, of course, he uses mystical terms, especially the Merkava and the Sod Eloah. But in any terminology, the point is fairly clear. Once God rests among Bnei Israel, once they have become the chariot, the Merkava that Yechezkel sees in Perek Aleph of Yechezkel, the Merkava that is the chariot of God in so much of the later Kabbalistic literature, Bnei Israel have become the Merkava, and in some sense, the divine presence is actually in or on their tents, as nechshevu ge'ulim, then they are redeemed. And we note that the Ramban has actually dropped one of the criteria that he mentioned earlier for what would be considered redemption. Earlier, he said it would have to be till they return to their ancestors' place, and they return to the level of their ancestors. Ad yom shuvam al-makomam ve'al-ma'alat avotam yashuvu. Now he's made it clear that their ge'ulim, as soon as God dwells among them, even though they actually spatially have not gotten to the land of Israel. So this is an important point in the Ramban, that in theory, full spiritual redemption can take place even outside the land of Israel. V'lachin, says the Ramban, nishlam ha-sefer hazeh b'hashlimo inyan ha-mishkan v'yot kvar Hashem malei oto tamid. So that's why Sefer Shemot ends when the Mishkan is built, and when the glory of God, the Kvod Hashem, fills it always. So Sefer Shemot, the Ramban, I think, is very insightfully observing, has a real identity. It starts with the beginning of the Galut, and so it has to go back and get some information from earlier in Breishit to start that story. And it ends at a reasonable time. It has a logical time. It ends with the Mishkan, because the Mishkan is the time where we actually have redemption. Of course, it's spiritual redemption, not physical redemption. It's not about liberation. It's about Kvod Hashem dwelling among Bnei Israel. Now, that at least allows us to approach the question of Vayikra. So Vayikra, the reason it's not obvious why Vayikra begins and ends where it does, is that Vayikra begins with the Korbanot. And if you ask, well, you know, where are the Korbanot taking place? What do they belong to? So the answer is that they clearly are related to the Mishkan from the end of Sefer Shemot. In other words, the question is not, does everything in Vayikra belong in Vayikra? The question is really, well, what about that stuff at the end of Shemot, though? Wasn't the Mishkan so the prerequisite to there being Korbanot? And isn't all of Vayikra actually just interested in the Mishkan itself, in the Ol Moed and Makom Kadosh, and the, you know, the different levels of Kedusha in those in that place? All of the Korbanot in our parsha and next week's parsha. Then we're going to get to Tumah and Tahara, which is, of course, essentially all about who can go in, who can't go into the Mishkan, under what circumstances someone can go in, rules of Kohanim, rules of Korbanot in the Mishkan. So all of Sefer Vayikra is essentially rules about what to do now that we have a Mishkan. So why is the Mishkan not actually in Sefer Vayikra? That's, I think, the way of asking the question that that frames our parsha. So our parsha starts with Korbanot, but Korbanot seems to be an odd place to begin. The Mishkan itself would have seemed to be a more reasonable place to begin. So we should think for a minute again about the structure of Vayikra. I just gave a sort of brief version of this orally, but we should think about this in a little bit more detail. So Vayikra, you know, you could divide it up in a bunch of different ways, but this seems like a plausible way to me. Vayikra has seven big chunks within it. The first seven prakim are the Korbanot. So that's basically this week's parsha and half of next week's parsha. Then we have Chet through Yud, which clearly are a unit unto themselves. The Chanukata Mishkan, the Chanukata Kohanim, and the Chet of Nadav and Avihu. So that moves from law into narrative. We actually get the description of what happened, Bayom HaShmini, of course, Parashat Shmini, and then the story of Nadav and Avihu taking upon themselves to do something that wasn't legislated and the ramifications of that. Then we move back to law, to the laws of Tumah and Tahara for another five prakim. And Tumah and Tahara, again, are intimately related to the Mishkan, Mikdash, and Kodashav. There's a very well-known and I think a very important Rambam at the end of, I should have counted, but many, many dozens of prakim describing all the rules of Tumah and Tahara. At the end of Hilchot Tumot Ochlin, the Rambam says, all that we've just said about Tumah and Tahara is irrelevant to the vast majority of people the vast majority of the time. But most people just never have to worry about whether or not they're Tameh or Tahar. So if you live in, I could say New York, but even if you live in Tveria, you don't have to worry about Tumah and Tahara. The Rambam says the only reason you have to worry about Tumah and Tahara is if you want to enter the Mikdash or if you want to partake of some of the Kodashim, which of course can include things like Truma as well, but only things that have to do with Mikdash v'Kodashav. In other words, Tumah and Tahara is really irrelevant, l'chachila irrelevant, to average Jewish life always. It's not just about our lives today, but Jewish life throughout history, and this is the way it was legislated. So the fact that Tumah and Tahara is in Vayikra, that's not an accident. That makes perfect sense. That's actually because it's all about access to the Mikdash and the Mishkan. After that, we get Yom HaKippurim, which is really a topic for a few weeks from now. But clearly Yom HaKippurim is at least an annual, but maybe more than that, opportunity to purify the Mikdash. I say maybe more than that because a number of commentators, both the Gra and Jacob Milgram, have observed that actually in most of Perek Tzayin, it never says anything about Yom HaKippurim. It's Bezot Yavo Aharon al HaKodesh, that Aaron could conceivably come maybe whenever he wants, whenever he feels a need to come to the Kodesh, as long as he does this particular tekes, this particular series of korbanot and other actions. But then the end of the perek says, you have to do this once a year. You have to do it on Yom HaKippurim. So there's a minimum number of times that one has to do it, but Torah is actually not clear that it has to be only once a year. But in any event, that's the ceremony of purifying the Mikdash. And then we turn to the section that's often called the section of Kedusha, which involves both Kedushat Ha'am, the very famous and justifiably famous Kedoshim to you, but also things about Kedushat HaKohanim, who Kohanim can marry, what they can do, who they can become Tameh for, and so on and so forth. Then we have another story in Perek Kav Daled of the Mikalel, and then that leads into the last section of the book, the last three Prakim, which are Bahar B'chukotai, which of course are the laws of Shemitah Yovel, but really Avadim, or Avadim included among those, and then the Tochacha at the end. So that I think is actually the hardest part of the book to characterize what those three Prakim have in common. But that's sort of overview of the book. Now, there's a really interesting hypothesis that's been floated. And for this, I need a little bit of background about the Mishkan itself. So again, the Ramban here in his commentary on the beginning of Parashat Truma, beginning of Perek Kafhei in Shmot, was the first one to observe that the Mishkan has exactly the same structure as Har Sinai. So first the observation again. So at Har Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu alone could go up to the top of the mountain. In the Mishkan, only the Kohen Gadol can go into the Kodesh Kodeshim. Then there's a class of people, the Aaron and a couple other people who were allowed on the slopes of Har Sinai. In the Mishkan, of course, that role is played by the Kohanim, who can go into the Kodesh, but not into the Kodesh Kodeshim. And then in both Har Sinai and the Mishkan, the rest of the people have to stay around, right? Either around the mountain or outside the Ohel Moed and the Chatzer and the Mikdash. So the Ramban is the first one to notice this. This is really important for the Ramban because he uses this to object to the claim, which I think is a well-known question, as to whether the Mishkan is lechatchila or whether the Mishkan was actually just a response to Chetah Egel. So of course, if we're reading the Torah straight, there's no reason to think that the Mishkan is a response to Chetah Egel. The Mishkan comes in Perek Kafhei. Chetah Egel is not till Lamed Bet. But Rashi, of course, very famously tells us, in Mukdam Mukhar B'Torah, actually Chetah Egel came first. And some slightly later philosophical-minded Rishonim did think that the Mishkan may actually not have been necessary had it not been for Chetah Egel. In other words, in plan A, Hashem never intended to tell anyone to build a Mishkan. He intended to simply dwell among the people. They would all have a direct relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. However, once he saw that they needed some sort of physical locus for worship, once Chetah Egel showed him that the sort of idyllic existence in the wilderness would not work, he said, fine, you know what? That's terrible. Let me give you something slightly less terrible. I'll give you a Mishkan, which at least has a hierarchy, at least it has rules, at least has korbanot, and at least I know that you're directing your worship towards me. So on this version, this understanding, the Mishkan is actually b'dieved as a result of Chetah Egel. The Ramban's point is that there's actually a deep connection between the Mishkan, not in Chetah Egel, but the Mishkan and Har Sinai. And he argues that we read the Torah in order. So Yesh Mukdam Mukhar B'Torah. And in fact, the significance of the Mishkan having the same structure of Har Sinai is that L'chadchila, Hashem's intention was, here, let me show you what Har Sinai looks like once here. And now I'm going to ask you to build the Har Sinai and take it with you everywhere you go. So you're going to build a little portable Har Sinai. You're going to replicate this experience and take it with you throughout the Midbar. So Har Sinai, according to the Ramban, was never meant to be a one-time thing. The plan always was one time experiences here on the mountain, and then structure your whole camp to replicate this experience with the Kodesh HaKodeshim in the middle, where Moshe's role, played by the Kohen Gadol, he will have access to that inner sanctum. Then there will be the Kohanim on the mountain, so to speak, in other words, in the Kodesh, and then the people will be around the Ohel Moed, and you'll now be able to transport this everywhere you go. So if you ask, like, well, how come we don't know where Har Sinai is? The Ramban's answer is because Har Sinai is wherever you build it. Har Sinai is actually meant to be replicable everywhere that there is the Machane Yisrael. Now, all of that is back in Sefer Shemot, of course. The anthropologist Mary Douglas cited the Ramban and said, you know what? It's not just that spatially the Mishkan is a portable Har Sinai, but she said this structure is actually the secret, or the key, let's say secret, is actually the key to understanding the structure of Vayikra as well. And this was her drawing of Vayikra. So let me try to explain. Hopefully you're looking at the screen. Try to explain what she did here. She said there are three parts of Vayikra. So you see the big part, Perek Aleph through Yud Zayin. She says that's all Korbanot. That's all Tumah and Tahara. That includes also the stories of the Chanukat HaMishkan and Nadav and Avihu. Then there's a second part that goes from Yurchet through Kaftal, through the Mikalel. That's the story. Well, the Mikalel, I'm sorry, the Mikalel is sort of the border. Through Chav Gimel Chav Dal, through the Korbanot of Emor. And then there's a third part, Chafei Chav Zayin. And I'll read to you the summary of her approach that I thought was said really well by my colleague Gary Rensberg. So this is the hypothesis. It's not just that the relative sizes of the three parts of Vayikra match the sections of the Mishkan, but their contents. Because here's how it goes. The first big section deals with the Korbanot. Where were the Korbanot done? Here, let me put up the next slide. So you see on the bottom here, the Chatzer. The Korbanot were, of course, performed in the Chatzer, at the Mizbach Adama, at the large Mizbeach outside the Mishkan. And Tumah and Tahara, which dictates who can enter or not enter the Mishkan. So all of these first 17 prakim deal with things outside of the Mishkan. They deal with things before you've ever gotten into the Mishkan. Then the Kodesh, this is the laws of the Kohanim. So the Kohanim are, of course, the ones who can go into the Kodesh. And then finally, the Kodesh Kodeshim, Douglas's theory is that the section, the end of Vayikra, is the Kodesh Kodeshim because it's the Brit, it's the covenant, and the covenant is represented by the Luchot and the Aron, so that sort of represents the Kodesh Kodeshim. It's the inner sanctum of the Mishkan. So in any event, that's her hypothesis about the structure of Vayikra. It's very hard to know whether this is correct or not, but I think it's a really exciting, interesting idea that the Ramban's idea that Har Sinai's structure was mirrored in the Mishkan also provides a key to the structure of Sefer Vayikra, and that literally all of Vayikra actually mirrors the Mishkan, which in turn mirrors Har Sinai. So that's something I'll put out there for you to think about. Okay, so where does this leave us? Well, when we talk about the let's zoom in a little bit on the on our parsha, because of course our parsha is the first part of this structure. So in our parsha we have the section on the laws of Korbanot, which of course are divided into sort of serial lists of laws. So we have the Olah, the Mincha, the Shlamim, the Chatat, the Asham. That's essentially our parsha. That takes us to the first five prakim of Vayikra. And then the next two prakim are also Hilchot Korbanot. And then we get, again, the Korbanot as they're offered by the Kohanim. And at the end of Perek Zayin, there's a very explicit summary of those two prakim. So that's clearly a unit. And then again, as we said, Perek Chet starts a new unit. Perek Chet starts a narrative unit of Yom HaShmini. So the Ramban, who of course is our literary structural guru here, so Ramban is in his Hakdama to Vayikra, which is actually fairly long, significantly longer than the Hakdama to Sefer Shemot. The Ramban says, "Ki kasher ya sefer echad binyan galut ve'gula mimenu, v'hishlimo binyan oel moed uchvod Hashem asher malei et ha-mishkan, tzivao b'korbanot v'shmirat ha-mishkan, shiyo korbanot kapara lahen, v'lo yigrimu ha-avonot l'salei kashchina." So I want to spend a couple of minutes unpacking what the Ramban seems to be saying here. So I said, I don't know, 15 minutes ago, that the question about Vayikra is, you know, why would you begin with the Korbanot? The Korbanot just seem to be part of the functioning of the Olam Moed. So go back to the Olam Moed, and starting from Parakaf Hei and Shmot, that should really be linked with Sefer Vayikra. So everything from Chaf Hei and Shmot till, I don't know where exactly, but at least through Parak Zion and Vayikra, should all be together. In other words, this is, here's how to build a Mishkan, here's all the Kalim, here's what to do in the Mishkan, here are the Korbanot to do. And yet, for some reason, those are severed. And the Ramban's point, I think, if I'm understanding his claim here correctly, is that actually that's a mistaken understanding. So there, and that's a very nice idea, but that question is based on a bad understanding of the Mishkan. The Korbanot are not there, are not linked to the Mishkan because that's what the Mishkan's there for. It's not true. The Mishkan is actually there, if you had read Maya Hakdama to Shmot well, the Ramban might say, the Mishkan is actually there not in order to do Korbanot. I disagree with that. The Mishkan is there in order to bring the Shekhinah down among Bnei Israel. The Mishkan is the place, Mishkan, the root from Shachan, right? Vasuli Mikdash v'Shachanti b'tocham. The Mishkan is primarily a resting place for God among Bnei Israel. That's actually why it exists. That's what it's constructed for. And that's why it is the fitting climax of Sefer Shmot. What about the Korbanot? So look again at what the Ramban said here. Oops, sorry about that. Look again at what the Ramban said. The Ramban said, Tzivahu b'korbanot v'shmirat ha-mishkan sheyihu ha-korbanot kapara lahen v'lo yigrimu ha-avonot l'salek ha-shchinah. The Korbanot are not there because that's why the Mishkan exists. On the contrary, the Korbanot are needed now that we have a Mishkan, because if we didn't have Korbanot, we're worried the Mishkan might not exist for a very long time. The primary purpose of the Mishkan is for God to rest among Bnei Israel. There's a problem, though. God can't tolerate bad actions, bad behaviors, and still dwell among Bnei Israel. He just can't do it. So we're concerned now. The Torah is now concerned that now that there's a Mishkan, people are going to start behaving badly. They're going to have the same chatem that they would have had otherwise. Not that they'll behave worse, they'll just behave badly, as human beings are wont to do. But now the stakes are higher, because if they behave badly, God's going to have to leave. In order to protect from that consequence, now we need all of Sefer Vayikra. Sefer Vayikra is essentially a way of protecting the geula that we had in Sefer Shmot. Sefer Shmot reached redemption by having Shechinat Hashem Mushra ben Bnei Israel. Now God rested among Bnei Israel. And now there's a concern that the Chataim, the Avonot, the Psha'im are going to drive him away. So along comes Sefer Vayikra and says, okay, now we have to worry about this. So for the Ramban as well, Sefer Vayikra is in a sense, I don't want to say this too strongly, but in a sense, b'dieved. In the sense that Korbanot are not inherently desirable. They're desirable, according to his Hakdama here, they're desirable because they protect the Mishkan from otherwise being offended by people's sins, and thus driving away the Shekhinah. Now, this, of course, might sound surprising because there's a very famous debate between the Rambam and Ramban, which is usually cast in exactly the terms, are Korbanot l'chachila or b'dieved. The Rambam, in the Mor Nevuchim, is explicit that Korbanot are b'dieved. And he means it in a much more radical sense than what the Ramban just said in his Akdama de Vayikra. The Rambam says that Korbanot are actually not desirable by God at all. God doesn't care about Korbanot. He even implies that God doesn't care about tefillah. L'chachila, God just wants people to sit quietly, achieve philosophical, moral, and physical perfection, and contemplate his oneness. But he realized that Bnei Israel were in no position to do that as they left Mitzrayim, and that if he had said, listen, you know, Israelites, from now on, now that I've taken you out of Egypt, I want you to sit around on hilltops and meditate on my oneness, he would have lost them immediately. They would have said, look, you know, we're used to worshiping idols. We know Egypt, we have temples, we have grand sacrificial rituals. So, you know, if you're just offering us like meditation on hilltops, contemplating oneness, we're going to go back to that. So according to the Rambam, Hashem said, okay, fine. Here's a better idea. Better idea is at least worship only me. So I don't need korbanot, but if you need to offer korbanot, offer them only to me. At least now the people are monotheists, and that's a major step forward, Rambam says. So he's educated them to be monotheistic through korbanot, but korbanot in and of themselves are not all that important. This has raised the question for many interpreters of the Rambam, whether the Rambam really thinks or needs to think that we need to return to korbanot in Bayit Shlishi. The Rambam is actually explicit that we do. And it's very vanishingly rare to find Rishonim who don't think so. The one voice that's sort of explicit on this point is Rav Yosef Albo, a couple of centuries later, who in fact draws the conclusion that we don't need to go back to Korbanot and Bayit Shlishi because they were only a compromise needed for ancient times. But now that we're all of a spiritual standing that don't require Korbanot, we don't need to go back to them when there's a future Beit HaMikdash. But all of this is for the Rambam. The Ramban, in his parish on Vayikra, on our parsha, on Vayikra Perek Aleph Pasuk Tet, mentions the Rambam, he cites him, condemns him in extraordinarily harsh terms, and says that actually there is deep significance to Korbanot. He actually says that there's two different levels of significance to Korbanot. He says there are some people who say that a korbanot are meant to be apotropaic. That's not exactly his word, but in other words, that people offer a korban, I offer the sheep, I really should be offering myself. But that's extreme. I don't need to offer myself on the altar. So instead I offer a sheep and should contemplate the fact that really I deserve to offer myself if I've sinned, but instead I use a sheep to take my place, or a cow or a bird, wherever it may be. Then the Ramban says that actually there's a deeper meaning, al derech ha'emet. Al derech ha'emet, as I'm sure you've all noticed, is the Ramban's way of saying, actually there's a Kabbalistic truth here. So I'm not going to try to explicate his Kabbalistic truth, but I'll send you to that commentary on Vayikra Aleph Pasuk Tet for the Ramban's own view of that. But all of this has led, and this has come back to our point, all of this has led many people to say that for the Rambam, korbanot are b'dieved, but for the Ramban, they're in fact l'chachila, they're desirable in and of themselves. What we see in his Hakdama is that they are necessary in and of themselves, and they may in fact have deep spiritual significance, but actually they're not there inherently because that was the point of it. Rather than saying that the Mishkan was built in order to offer korbanot, the Ramban says, the Mishkan is there for Hashra'at HaShechina. The Mishkan is there because the Shechina is to be present among Bnei Yisrael. Now that the Shechina is to be present among Bnei Yisrael, now we have to have korbanot to protect that Mishkan, to make sure that there's kapara, to make sure that there's a way of atoning for any chataim that take place. And all of the korbanot, all of Sefer Vayikra essentially, is a way of protecting the Mishkan. So I hesitate to say it this way, but I'll say it anyway just to make it clear the point. Vayikra is less important than Shemot. I don't want to, now I'll take that back, but hopefully you understand the point. In other words, the Mishkan is there on purpose. That's really the goal. That's the geula. Once we have a Mishkan, we now need to have a lot of laws to protect the Mishkan. And that's Sefer Vayikra. But Vayikra is really only there as a protection for what we accomplish in Sefer Shemot. So that's, I think, the Ramban's approach, and it seems like a very, very compelling approach. The key point is as follows. The Mishkan should not be understood, according to Ramban, as just the place that had to be constructed in order to perform korbanot. If that were true, then obviously it would be linked textually in the same book with all the korbanot. Actually, the Mishkan is far more important than just a place to do korbanot. The Mishkan is a place for the Shechina to rest among Bnei Yisrael, and that's in fact portable. I think that's an important thing to say. The Ramban, in his Hakdama to Shemot, as you recall, said that this could be done anywhere. They didn't have to be on Har Sinai. It could be replicated anywhere. And that's the point of the Mishkan. Bnei Yisrael can actually bring the Shekhinah to rest in their midst. Now that we have that, we need to have a whole lot of laws to make sure that this structure doesn't fall apart. Of course, it did fall apart, but only many, many centuries later. If you think about some of the things that Yechezkel says at the end of his book, he actually says that despite all of these laws, Bnei Yisrael still were too close. They were encroaching on the Mikdash, and that's why the Beit HaMikdash had to be destroyed eventually. But that's for a later time. Okay, one last point about our Parsha, and this is something that's really crucial for understanding Vayikra more generally, is that it's actually surprising that Torat Kohanim, as Chazal call it, is public. And when I say public, we all know how our Parsha begins. And our Parsha, of course, begins with the most public call possible. So, of course, our Parsha begins not just with the word Vayikra, but Vayikra Moshe by Deber Hashem Elav, Me'ol Moed Lemor, Deber El Bnei Yisrael V'Amarta Lehem, and so on. So, in other words, Hashem calls to Moshe and says, go speak to Bnei Israel and tell them all the laws of Korbanot, all the laws of Tumah and Tahara. And this is a serious question. You see, my teacher, Professor Jeff Tige, has a short article about this on a website that's there linked on the bottom. Why are laws for priests included in the Torah? In other words, the Torah is fundamentally a public text. Talmud Torah is meant for everyone. And yet, many of the laws here are not needed by the vast majority of people. Most of us don't need to know the exact rituals for how to do korbanot. Most of us don't need to know the exact laws of who a kohen can and can't marry. But it's not just that they're in the Torah and so we're sort of eavesdropping on them, like they were directed at the Kohanim, but we're all listening in. It explicitly says, go tell this to all of Bnei Israel. So that's actually a somewhat surprising finding, so surprising observation. And in fact, in the ancient Near East, we know that there were ritual texts for priests that were not public. They were in the temples, they were consulted by priests, but no one else knew what was in them. Everyone else essentially entrusted the priests with this knowledge and said, you worry about how to control the temple. It's not our job. So Tige makes the point, and he actually points out that this is in the Sifra as well. So this is Sifra all the way down in Emor on another on the law on the pasuk that talks about whom Kohanim can marry. And again, by the Moshe Aaron v'Elbanav v'Elkol Bnei Yisrael. So Sifra points out, like, why do all Bnei Yisrael have to know who the Kohanim can marry? And Sifra says, Hisir et Aaron al yidei banim. In other words, he's here at Tabanim Ayyadei Israel. The point Sifra makes is that by Moshe telling all of Bnei Israel whom the Kohanim can marry and can't marry, we're actually saying the Kohanim are responsible, they have to answer to all of Bnei Israel. There is nothing esoteric here, there's nothing secret here. The Kohanim can't go into the Beit HaMikdash and say, you know, we do ritual stuff here. You don't understand it. You don't know what we're supposed to be doing. Don't worry about it. It's in our hands and it'll all be fine. Secrecy is actually not allowed in the Torah, even when it comes to the Mikdash B'Kodeshav. Sefer Vayikra starts by saying, all of Bnei Israel need to know this. Daber el Bnei Israel v'amartal lehem. Tell everyone, here's the laws of the Korbanot. Here's how everyone's going to do Korbanot. And that's a really important point that Tige develops in that article that was linked on that slide, about the democratization of knowledge starting from the Torah and essentially throughout Jewish history and culture. In Jewish culture, there has always been an ethos that all of knowledge, including the most esoteric knowledge, I should exclude, I guess, Kabbalah from this, but anything that's halachic or agadic, this is out there for everyone to learn. There's no ethos of secrecy. There's no sense that there is a caste of people and only they have access to this knowledge. On the contrary. And the truth is, there's all sorts of historical evidence for this being not just an ideal, but a real existence for Jews, as that that Jews were, on the whole, vastly more literate than populations throughout history. That this extended in pre-modern times even to, not on such a wide scale, but on some scale, to women as well. In Eastern Europe, in the 19th century, the estimates are that 95% of adult men, Jewish adult men, were literate in Hebrew, which is extraordinary. And that's because, of course, virtually every Jewish boy was sent to cheder from age, you know, roughly 4 to 13 or so. Even if they went to be a cobbler from that point on, they were literate. And you have to remember that in the 19th century, thinking about Russia or, you know, what's now Poland, literacy rates for the general population were, I actually don't have good numbers, but I'm going to think something about 15-20% of the general population. So there's an extraordinary value placed on access to knowledge in Jewish culture. And Antigua's point, which again, citing the Sifra, that starts here. That starts right at the beginning of our parsha, something that we almost would overlook. This sort of conventional, the Beryl B'nai Yisrael v'amarta alehem, that's not conventional. That's actually extraordinary. The fact that Torat Kohanim says that it should be promulgated to the people means that the Kohanim are responsible to the people. As the Sifra said it, he's here at the Kohanim, etabanim al yidei Yisrael. So there's an accountability aspect to this, and there's an education aspect to this, that Torah ought to be spread to all of B'nai Israel and is not in the hands of just a few. And with that, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom. I feel like everything today we should be talking about coronavirus. I have nothing insightful to say about it. So we'll escape into Vayikra a little bit for that. And Shabbat Shalom, all the best, and Chag Kasher Sameach.
Shabbat Shalom, Rab. Mr.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's Rabbi or not.
Aaron,
okay. Thank you for your insights. They were quite interesting.
Thank you.
I never looked at it on that point of view. So now when I read it tomorrow, Mirza Hashem, I will understand it on a higher level.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
It's the highest praise. Thank you.
Okay, Shabbat Shalom and have a Chag Kosher Sameach.
Professor.
Hello, Moshe.
Yeah, hi. I have a question. That literary map sort of structure that you showed us from Mary Douglas or whatever her name was, are there any, you said you were sort of like iffy on whether it really applied here, whether it was like accurate. Are there any instances in Tanakh, I guess, where you would say there is a definite sort of like literary structure that somehow like, you know, maps to like a concept in like in the theme, like that sort of thing? Are there any instances where you would say that like it's clear in the text?
No, I don't know. I don't have a great example of it. No, I think this is a kind of a hypothesis that I haven't seen elsewhere. Really fascinating, but I don't know how to verify it. You know, some of it she develops in a little bit more detail than I did here. So she actually thinks the narratives, Chet Riyud and Chaf Dalet, are the screens, the masachs between.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You could have a look at her work or Gary Rensberg, who I mentioned, wrote about this, and his work is online. If you Google something like Gary Rensberg, Mary Douglas, Leviticus, you'll find his article. I think that's a good place to do it. All right. But yeah, good to hear from
you.
All right. So have a good Shabbos, everyone.
Is there a way to print your sources?
You know what? I can upload the slideshow right now. Hold on a second. I should be able
And
to.
How do I get it?
If you're on the chat, I could, why can't I do this? Maybe only the host can do this. I will have to ask Rabbi Kelman to send it out then. I unfortunately seem to not.
Because if you upload it to the sheet that says how to get into this, if somehow it's on that cover sheet, so when we click it, we can also, it says source. I've seen on other Zooms, it says source sheet on the bottom.
Okay, very good. So I'll send it to Rabbi
Kelman.
And then
we can get it.
I don't seem to have a lot of control over the Zoom session. So I'll send it to Rabbi Kelman and ask him to distribute it however he distributes things.
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a good Shabbos.
Absolutely. Have a good Shabbos.
Can I ask a question?
Oh.
Do you hey. Greenfield?
Hi, Yehuda. How are you? I'm good.
I want to ask about, you're speaking about how knowledge is democratized. And I wrote this in a chat, but I don't think you saw it. The Gemara talks about like a certain family that had the secret of the Ketores and how they
with a
Beit Ashan.
Beit Avtinas, so, is that right?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but
that's right.
But like, so that's the case of knowledge not being democratized and being kind of hidden.
That's true.
Good yeah, point. So and also like this is a point my wife made while she was listening, which is like if because the knowledge is democratized, like that made it that like other families can like, you know, like the whole fight between the dynasties of like the Hashmonaim becoming Kohen Gadol or like who's gonna be the Kohen, like that's only possible because they all knew exactly what to do. But if only one family knew like the Kohen Gadol procedure, then we would never have had right. the Hashmonaim taking over the Kohen Gadol or that sort of stuff that led to the Dead Sea Sect and that stuff.
There's a downside to everyone having knowledge.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Well, I mean, that's a good point. There is the possibility for people who shouldn't be acting on that knowledge to think that they can. Not to judge any of the people you mentioned, but like in theory, you know, once knowledge is out there, anyone can say like, oh, good, I have this knowledge. I can do this. What do I need you for? I think that's true today, right? I mean, that's essentially the dynamic of, since I have Google, what do I need rabbis for?
Right. And like the Ketores thing is like example of like, maybe sometimes having it in a specific family is a good thing.
Interesting. Although I think the Mishnah actually says that Chachamim condemn them for keeping the knowledge themselves.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. But maybe when they needed it, when we need to democratize, that's when we should do it.
Right. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I think we all know today that there are pros and cons to democratizing knowledge. People do feel experts when they shouldn't feel experts. You know, this is a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Overall, at least our impulse seems to be that it's still better than esotericism, but it's a tough one. I mean, it's not obvious. Or at least we can certainly agree that there are costs to democratizing knowledge. It's not just an entirely good, all good. Like there are definitely costs that we pay for doing that. I think that's a good point.
Okay. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely. All right. Wonderful. It's good to hear from you. So I guess have a good Shabbos now.